Make sure Representative Morgan.
Thank you.
The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division Committee meeting will come to order. I'm sorry for the delay. We had a technological problem that has been clarified. The first item on our agenda tonight is to continue the committee discussion on House Legislative Guide Draft 2. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess first I should move adoption of the January 20 draft of the legislative guide to bring it before the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the public, I come before you today to offer for adoption in this committee a legislative guide developed under Laws 2009, Chapter 172. The law requires this committee, appropriate Senate committees, and the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council to develop a guide stating the principles for, the use, and expected outcomes of funds derived from the dedicated sales taxes imposed under Article 11, Section 15 of the Minnesota Constitution. Under the law, the guide will be in effect for the next 4 years. As chair of the subcommittee assigned to produce this committee's work under the law, I decided it would be best to follow the chair's example from the development of the committee investment goals adopted unanimously by this committee on March 9, 2009. To that end, beginning in August of 2009, I solicited the input of interested members of the public, stakeholder groups, GOP and DFL staff, nonpartisan House staff, and members from both sides of the aisle. This document would not have been possible without the input of more than 70 individuals and representatives of groups. In particular, I would like to thank Mr. McCormick, Mr. Shepard, and Ms. Taylor in House Research, Ms. Roberts and Mr. Soderberg, our fiscal analysts, Mr. Dwight, Mr. Musilevich, Ms. Anton, and Ms. Conley, Representative Hawes, and of course you, Madam Chair, for your help in putting this document together. I think it is very important to emphasize the deliberative process we went through in developing this document. To that end, I'd like to share the timeline of events regarding this process. Back in August, on the 25th of August, 2009, we had a committee meeting. At that meeting, there was discussion with committee members about the legislative guidelines required under the law. No member input had been received yet prior to this meeting, even though it was requested. So we re-requested, if you will, member input and asked it be submitted prior to our September 8 meeting. We had a second committee hearing on September 8th of 2009. At that meeting, Mr. Shepard presented his memo about the legislative guide provision and the committee investment goals adopted last year. Chair Murphy indicated that I would take the lead in coordinating the legislative guide, and I asked members and members of the public to present information and background relevant to the purpose of this guide by Tuesday, September 15th. On the 22nd of September 2009, there was a legislative guide meeting with members and staff. This included House Research, and Representative Hawes was at that meeting. Together, we discussed the input we received up to that point. On September 27th, we met again with staff and Representative Hawes, and we went over a rough draft developed by Ms. Conley based on the discussion we had had at the previous meeting and all the input we had taken to that point. We discussed any new input that we had not discussed at the previous meeting, and Ms. Conley was asked to take those comments and put together a revised draft. On December 14, 2009, at a committee hearing open to the public, I presented the first draft of the legislative guide, and I asked for member input and public input. This draft was distributed to the public at that time. I asked that members and the public should respond by December 31 with any comments, concerns, issues, additions, subtractions they would like to see made to that first draft of the legislative guide. On January 12, 2010, there was another legislative guide meeting with staff, including fiscal, House Research, and GOP caucus staff, and Chair Murphy. We again discussed the draft and the public input we had received up to that point, and we asked House Research to prepare a revised draft. On January 19, 2010, we had another legislative guide meeting with staff and Chair Murphy. We discussed their draft. We recommended some simple changes to further streamline and focus the text of the draft, the content of the draft. And the next day, on January 20, we presented what you see before you now, Draft 2 of the legislative guide, asking for further member discussion. At that committee hearing, the public was told that we would prefer, like to hear input on the Draft 2, including any amendments that would be requested at this hearing to be submitted 24 hours prior to this meeting. To my knowledge, there has been only one amendment submitted. Madam Chair, the first draft of this document, released on December 14th, was designed to be as inclusive of the input we received without being too prescriptive or specific and trying not to be contradictory. We also tried to incorporate the spirit of the investment goals adopted last session, and we tried to address some of the issues that had arisen since then in a productive manner. Admittedly, that document was too long and lacked focus. After hearing further public feedback, we sat down, as I described, with House Research and staff to streamline and focus the document to something that was workable and to focus on the truly important concepts, principles, and outcomes that this committee has continued to discuss over time. This document has been public for more than 2 weeks now, and the feedback I have received so far is that we were successful in this endeavor. Now, certainly some have expressed to me some concerns on some issues within the document. However, their anxiety level was clearly reduced when I shared with them my vision of the purpose of the guide. So I would like to share that now if it helps others who have some of those concerns. I see this legislative guide as exactly that, a guide. I think it should be seen to communicate to the public and stakeholders what this committee thinks is important for the next 4 years. We tried to make sure the language included words like should and may, not shall and must. I do not think this guide should be interpreted to prescribe or prohibit particular actions or behaviors that are not already included in law. It is my hope that the legislative guide is seen as a statement to the public, stakeholders, and those who would seek appropriations of funds under the legacy amendment of the principles and outcomes we, as a committee, would like them to consider and strive to provide with these funds. Of course, I would be pleased if we could agree with the Senate, the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, and in fact any other stakeholder groups who have participated with this committee as we've begun this 25-year journey together on these or similar principles and outcomes. At the very least, if adopted, it will communicate the general principles and expected outcomes that we, as a committee, believe will provide the taxpayers the most transparent process and the best possible outcomes. And with that, Madam Chair, I look forward to a discussion.
Committee members? I appreciate the time that you put into this, and I appreciate the input from the over 70 people and organizations that also submitted testimony either in committee or in written form to the committee. And the draft seems to me to be, draft two seems to me to be a document that could work. Are there any amendments? Representative Davis.
Madam Chair, no amendments. Before we get into the amendments, if I could just ask a couple of clarifying questions. First of all, Minnesota Session Law 172 says that we should be doing this. Does the Session Law have any timeline when this needs to be done? That's one part of the question. The question is, how does this match up? Does the Lasard-Sams Council take a vote, and then the Senate takes a vote, and it goes to the floor of the House and Senate, or what's the process here?
Madam Chair, Representative
David Morgan.
I can't speak as to what would happen after this guide is or is not adopted by this committee. It is not my intent that this legislative guide would take the form of law. Again, I see it as a guide. There are already provisions accounted for in the law. I don't know what the Senate or the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council would choose to do either with this document or whether they are going to meet the obligations under the law and prepare their own documents. And then we're going to get together to see where we can find common ground. I don't know what those two bodies would choose to do. But I feel that we have met our obligation under the law if we choose to adopt this document.
Representative David.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Mr. McCormick or Mr. Shepherd, after it was a lot clearer on what happens after January 15th when this document was supposed to be done.
Madam Chair and members, the law didn't specify a process for trying to resolve any differences between the three groups that were designed to participate jointly in this. And so I think that's up to the groups. So there is no particular process clearly outlined in the law.
It was our intent from the beginning to share this with the other with the Senate and with the Lessard Heritage or the Lessard-Sams Heritage Council and anyone else that asks, right?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Representative Wagenius, you submitted an amendment that came in before deadline on Friday.
And I'd like to move that amendment, though, members, you were just handed out the one that I'd like us to work from because the wrong one was put in the packet. So you're looking at one that has 2-5-2010 on top with it, this little handwritten note. There's only one difference, and I'll just go through that. So I would like to move the amendment. Would you like me to describe it?
Yes. Representative Wagenius moves adoption of MSHRD on February 5th, 2010, 3:53 p.m. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. These are not huge amendments, but I think they do clarify and make it easier for the public to understand the guide. So I'll just start with on page one. It talks about the legislative auditor or another auditor. Actually, it is only the legislative auditor's responsibility to do these audits, and we have had communications from a legislative auditor to that effect. The second, on line 12, 13, that is just a grammatical error or change. On line 18, the drinking water, it says drinking water protection shall be focused on public health, and that is correct. But there is a slight implication in the way it's currently written that some people's drinking water may be more important than other people's drinking water, and we didn't want that to happen. So it just says that achievable results should be expected, and that would mean it's fair for everybody. When we get down to line 23, we're just clarifying that the waters we're talking about are groundwaters and surface waters. And members, when we talk about groundwater, we talk about it being degraded, not impaired. And that is the constitutional language, protect groundwater from degradation. So we're just following the constitutional language. If you get down to line 27, I think when we talk about prevention, it's just not things that we see in our water bodies that tell us that our water is not healthy, like curly leaf pine weed, but it's things in our waters, too, that we may not see that are harming our fish. And so that's why I added endocrine disruptors, pharmaceuticals, and antibiotics. The next bullet talks about drinking water protection being highly visible. If you're dealing with contaminants that are not seen, it would not be highly visible. So I just said instead efforts to protect drinking water should be very visible. I think that's what we were really trying to get at. Let me go on here. When we talk about, we're not going to be assessing our waters just once. We're in 10 years. We're going to be doing it on a 10-year cycle. And our measurement that we use is not how much fish we eat and what's in the fish, but it really is the biological integrity of things in our waters that we're looking at it. And again, in the next bullet down, I just added degraded because we're referring to both groundwater and surface water, and degraded applies to groundwater. One of the members, and I don't take credit for this, noted that we sometimes use different words to talk about Minnesotans, people, or the public, and so we just put in Minnesotans in the appropriate places. And then the last one, I think, on line 23, on the second page, it's just a easier way of saying things. And with that, I'm glad to take questions, and I would renew my motion.
Representative Morgan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Representative Wagenius for discussing her proposed changes with me, and I support them and her amendment.
Any questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wagenius, on page 2, I believe it's line 13, 14. Did you mean to leave out state recreation areas, or?
I'm
you have increase in the percentage of Minnesotans who report having visited a regional or state park. Did you mean to put in state recreation areas as well?
Well, I'll tell you, when I was working on this, I was only looking at the water section, and so I did not go over the rest of it with a fine-tooth comb. It's just that somebody suggested to me that we were using different words for Minnesotans, and so that's why this appears here. I mean, I think that's something you may want to consider, but that wasn't something I was looking at.
Okay. Do you want to ask your question of Representative Morgan? Because his committee is the one that put the original language in on page 4.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to ask that question of Representative Morgan.
We're really looking off of page 4 under outcomes, mending the second and third bulletin, but I think maybe you're asking for a little more.
Yes.
Then, Representative Morgan, did you consider using state recreation areas?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, thank you for the question. To be honest, no, we didn't. This was in the Parks and Trails section. And I just never got into any one of the drafts.
Madam Chair, well,
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Perhaps Representative Morgan just includes state recreation areas in there, and would be.
Madam Chair, is Representative Erdahl offering to amend the
guide
or Representative Wagedius's amendment?
Which would you rather have me do?
I think I would rather you you not offer that as an amendment, because I think there could be financial consequences. But I would like to make a note that as it travels on its way, that we, and when we're discussing it, we should discuss it with the other groups. We should talk about state recreational areas, whether that should be part of it.
Okay, just.
And I think Representative Morgan and I and whoever else takes it on its way would commit to doing that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, in promotional materials and things that I've seen, usually they list the state parks, and then the state recreation areas are listed in there as well. So they are.
They're together.
They're together.
Yeah. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Representative Erdahl's point, until I was on this committee, I just had not really become aware of what a state recreational area is. And since the reference here is the percentage of Minnesotans who report having visited a regional or state park or used a regional trail, you know, most of those things are pretty clearly labeled, and you know if you've been in one. But I'm not sure if that's always true of state recreation areas. And I think, you know, we ought to look at that to see whether or not that would be a good measure of whether or not people knew if they'd even been there or not. I'm not sure, because it sounds like those are a lot less formally sort of promoted and the trails known, that sort of thing.
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Don't want to belabor it anymore, but I think, you know, they are fairly well delineated. I mean, there aren't really that many of them.
You have a special interest in one, don't you?
I have special interest in many things, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. But tell us the name of it.
Well, you see, thank you, Madam Chair. Very brief history. You know, when I read that Vermilion State Park is the first state park created for, 30, 40 years, there was, for a brief time, Greenleaf Lake State Park. It's one of those footnotes to history that was quickly erased and became a state recreation area. And that's why I'm, making this particular emphasis today. So there is Greenleaf Lake State Recreation Area, just south of Litchfield, and you're all welcome to go there someday.
And it has unique features.
It does.
Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair, I just wondered whether by any chance research staff could just immediately give us a sense of whether that would be the appropriate place to add recreational area, given the context.
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, yes, if the committee wanted to add that concept, I think perhaps on the bullets that refer to the State Parks and Trails Fund having visited a regional or state park or state recreational area, and on the next bullet, increase in the percentage of Minnesotans who visited a state or regional park or state recreation area.
And to the chair's question, she wondered if it had a fiscal impact
and constitutional impact.
Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, I'm not familiar offhand with the state recreation areas, and so I think I need to think a little bit more about how it fits in. I'd need to learn more to think about how it fits in with the concept of supporting parks and trails of statewide or regional significance. I just don't know enough about it to really comment off the top of my head.
I think it'd be equal to a regional park, but if it's not equal to a state park, at least it would be equal to a regional park. But I don't know if it meets the constitutional language. Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, did Representative Erdahl just say state recreational area, or did he say state or regional recreational area?
He said state.
Okay. I think that that's a concept, and I think that there are more than, that there's more than one of them.
Yeah, there's one, like, isn't Big Bog a recreational area?
Is it? Maybe we should get someone from DNR to tell us how many are listed.
There are two.
Look at both hands.
There's two on one side, a whole hand on the other.
There are seven.
Seven. Thank God we didn't get better than 10.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
And they are listed in statute, aren't they?
Yes.
I think I agree with Representative Erdahl. I think that there is, you know, my guess is that people visiting them, my guess is that it's well known as whether it's a regional or state park, you know, the people in the area. Because I remembered when we made, but I had all of them, I remember when we made something a regional, state recreational area instead of a state park was because, you know, the implications, the fiscal implications of having a state park were less than the fiscal implications of having a recreational area, yet gave it some kind of prominence. So.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
I think there's a big distinction between a regional park and a regional recreational area that you probably do not want to jump over, but I do not see that much of a difference between a state park and a regional.
And a state recreational
area. And a state recreational area.
I just wanted to make sure, Madam Chairman, I wasn't sure what he had said, and I didn't think that the concept of regional recreation area was something that really existed. So I didn't want that in, but I think the state one works as well.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, we took a great deal of care to try to stay within the constitutional guidelines, within the intent of the language of the Constitution. And I think one of the reasons we asked for amendments to come in 24 hours ahead of time, with all due respect to Representative Erdahl, was so that we could check on things like this. So I don't personally have any problem with the seven state recreational areas being in here, but I do worry that without having the time to research whether it works, if we're operating off of conjecture and best guesses, I would prefer not to add it this time, but as you suggested earlier, move forward with that in our minds.
Or we could delay the final vote for another meeting.
That would be fine with me, too.
Any other questions or statements about the Wagenius Amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, members.
Tom Jess. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Jess.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, as I said to several of you offline after the last committee meeting, that this document was far and away an improvement over the last document. Having had time to read it a little bit more thoroughly, I've seen some areas that, you know, a little bit of concern or maybe some small changes that can be made. So. With that, on page one, you know, the last bulleted item wants to have a lot of consideration given to jobs. I mean, under the current economy, I can see where that might be something that you'd want to consider, but overall, I think the people that voted for the amendment voted for it to protect the fish, game, and wildlife habitat with clean water and the other two entities that that were on the ballot. So I don't know that, you know, that if that, again, that since Representative Morgan said that it's a guide, whether or not, you know, a lot of priority should necessarily be given to that. If jobs are created because of some of the work that's going to be done, I think that's great, but I don't know that it should be an overall item that should be, it should be the primary focus. On page 2 of the document, bullet number 3 is encouraging a lot of local input from interest groups and such. And I'm just wondering what is meant here, you know, really thinking outside the box. Are we saying that a local PTA will have input on a habitat or clean water project, or would they, or is this more with them having input on something for the arts? And then going on, under the Outdoor Heritage Fund principles, priority acquisition should have multiple uses and be throughout the state, including the metro area. There's not any problem with that, except as long as the fish, game, and wildlife habitat doesn't become so disturbed that it's a detriment to the process of improving the habitat and increasing the fish, game, and wildlife populations, which some, you know, projects under the Outdoor Heritage Fund are actually funded. Under the outcomes on page 3, again, as far as the mountain bikers, snowmobiles, and ATV users being, you know, going into those lands that are improved, protected, and enhanced with the Outdoor Heritage Fund, I see some possible conflicts, and again, where the you know, the uses of that land might need to be restricted to those three groups only because it's a disturbance to the wildlife, and it may impede some of the, you know, outcomes that we're trying to get. Now, the third bulletin item in that group, I think with a change of a couple of words, I think that can be made a lot more meaningful, where it says increase in the fish, game, and wildlife populations in the state consistent with long-term population trends. I think you know, the reason for the amendment was to try and stave off the long-term downward trends of some of the wildlife populations, and I would think that maybe we would want to put in there long-term DNR population goals to make it a little bit more meaningful. Then going down three more bullets, invasive species will be prevented or mitigated. I'm not sure how much money the committee wants to throw at invasive species from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Thinking back to, you know, the elm bark beetle, and what happened to the elm trees until we got some disease-resistant tree or stock that might make the elms a little bit, give them a comeback. But I'm not sure if that might be something that could be put underneath the LCCMR for research and development, if you will. Clean Water Fund. Let's see, funds may be used to set water quality standards for surface water, groundwater, and drinking water. Aren't these standards already exist at the federal level with PCA as far as contaminants in the water?
Representative Guinness.
I can help out here. we have to set some of our own standards for surface water. Like, right now, we don't have a standard. The PCA doesn't have a standard for nitrogen. And we know, we all know, I think everybody understands how harmful that is to our lakes, rivers, and streams. So that's one example of something I can think of. And we can have stricter drinking water standards than the federal government.
Okay.
Mr. Jess.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, thank you. Along that line, then, would we want to be looking at standards then for chloride pollution? I believe those do exist, and with regards to the metro waters, with regards to, say, Nine Mile Creek, Minnehaha Creek, because the prevalent contaminant in those waters happens to be chlorides from road salt. And then we've got a little bit of a paradox. The document says that groundwater and drinking water recharge areas may be acquired through permanent easements or fee title for the purpose of preventing, reducing, or eliminating contamination. I say paradox because in some of the discussions from the committee before, there were questions as to whether or not there should be fee title in acquisition or easement with regards to wildlife lands. And, you know, we're saying we can't do it with one, but it's okay to do it with the other. And then if we do protect those, how do we protect those? Do we go along with a New York model where on New York's reservoirs for drinking water for New York City, they're scattered all across upstate New York. Some of them are some pretty nice looking bodies of water, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 acres, but there's no motorized boats allowed on those waters for fear of contamination. So if you do that, do you do the same thing here for groundwater recharge and, you know, restrict motor access to those waters? And I think that is it.
Thank you, Mr. Jess, for your thoughtful remarks. Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Jess, I wanted to respond to the acquisition question, because I think if you read that bullet point on groundwater and drinking water recharge, it says may be acquired. And the issue with the other acquisitions was that protection would only be acquisition.
Right.
And so here you have a may that gives the option for acquisition either of easement or fee title. And I think that's perfectly consistent with law, which was passed at the end of the year, which says that acquisition is an option, but not the sole purpose for protection.
Thank you. Any other comments? Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman and Mr. Jess, I'm a little, on your second page, when you say invasive species are not discussed in the Constitution section that I have copied, when I'm looking at the Constitution, I'm looking at the words that say, and may be spent only to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. Right. And it seems to me that removing invasive species and controlling invasive species is completely covered by that phrase in the Constitution. I don't quite see how you come to the conclusion that it's not included in the Constitution.
Mr. Jess?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn. Partly because we took $2 million out of the recommendations that the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council made last year. Okay, and do we keep increasing, or do we keep spending money to try and reduce that? And is that something that we fully want to do when it's something that, looking at the long-term history of what happened with the elm trees, that we spend all kinds of money with regards to that, and we really didn't. The only way to do it was to kind of let Mother Nature take its course and spend the time looking for disease-resistant species of elm trees in order to reforest, if you will.
Representative Kahn.
Looking around the table, I think I'm the only person who was in the legislature when we dealt, maybe you were too, two of us were in the legislature when we dealt with the elm tree problem. What we did was we put a very large amount of money, $20 million sticks in my mind, into reforestation. It's available in communities and also on public lands and so forth. And when you look down, we hadn't done that. When you look down Summit Avenue right now, it would be totally bare. And we didn't just look for we didn't spend the money looking for a disease-resistant elm tree to allow that. But the question that I asked simply, and I think the decision of what should be done is made by the legislature as advised by the Lassard Sands Council. But I don't, when I'm looking at the constitutional language, I don't see how control of invasives, and so one can at any time argue about how much we should spend on it and what's appropriate or not, but I don't see how it's not included in the constitutional language, which says restore, protect, and enhance. Control of invasive species is certainly something that restores, protects, and enhances. So I don't want to argue right now about how much we should spend and whether we should do it and what funds should be used. I'm just objecting to the premise that it's not allowed by the constitutional language.
Any other comments for Mr. Jess? Thank you very much. Bob Austin, sportsman.
I don't have any comments or questions at this time. So
thank you. Okay. Madison Marindis. American Liberation Organization.
Thank you. what's drawn my attention to this amendment basically has to do with let me go ahead and say that I was very glad to see this amendment get voted through on the ballot last year. I think it's a good indication what Minnesotans are really looking for, and I believe they really are concerned about having their lands and water and air quality protected. And I guess I look at this more as not as a guide, but as possible legislation to help enforce that. I may not have the full gist of what the guide is all about. I've only looked at it for the past week, but there are some concerns I do have over it. First off, let me say one thing about my organization. It's a small group of people that are basically working to make sure that corporate interests are not taking advantage of the American people. And I'm working with other organizations to kind of help give the American taxpayer a little bit of an edge against what seems to be a corporate monopoly against American politics. The other issue I have with this, with the compliance on it, I didn't see anything in here that talks about any ability to take action against environmental violators. My concern is that there's really nothing there to protect if someone decides to pollute. I know we have the MPA and the DNR, but it's been my experience in the past that these agencies do not seem to really enforce it. I see that they tend to work on behalf of special interests and corporate interests. So I was hoping to see something in here that would kind of take an extra foothold with that, even to the extent of taking part in environmental impact statements. I questioned the DNR's current environmental impact statements as taken, especially on the copper sulfide mining issue that's in the that seems to be going on across the state. Going down to priorities and substantive principles, I too had a question about the priority should be given to projects that leverage and maximize non-state money, improve the state or regional economy, create jobs, or increase community involvement. What concerns me there is that I agree that this really shouldn't be a jobs bill, but is there going to be involvement in allowing, for example, a mining corporation to come into an area and start developing, setting up operations, and it be approved because it's creating some temporary jobs, that this may have some involvement with that to help condone that kind of action. Under the Outdoor Heritage Fund, number four, at the seventh one down, expenditures should include habitat projects and habitat protection for purposes including scientific and natural areas. I guess I'd like to see that wording from should to will. Once again, I'd like to see this not so much as a guide, but something that's a little bit more concrete that's in favor of the environment and in favor of what the Minnesotans are expecting out of this. I think they're expecting a little bit more stronger action against the environment being destroyed from pollution and other impacts on the environment and destruction of habitat. There's a lot of things I like in this that I was glad to see happen. I think, for example, under outcomes, endangered, threatened, or species of concern will be protected. I don't see that being done in the state right now. I think the DNR is not really putting a lot of emphasis on that. I think there's influence going on there that concerns me that they're not acting in the best interest of the Minnesotan taxpayer. And last but not least, I see on the last part under the Clean Water Fund, groundwater and drinking water recharge areas may be acquired through permanent easement. What I'd like to see there is that this can take a priority over a corporation coming in and looking to develop land or harvest the land in some way that is going to damage drinking water and have a potential hazard with it. Right now we're looking at the groups coming in that are saying they can do it in a safe way and giving the okay to go ahead and do it and nothing being, and then once they do it, these corporations dissolve, they become part of a EPA Superfund, and people are not only in loss of their clean drinking water, but we've taken a big hit on the environment. And that essentially is my concerns with the whole proposal.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Representative Guinness.
I would just like to call your attention to some studies coming from the Pollution Control Agency and the DNR on groundwater and what should be done. There'll be a hearing tomorrow morning on the DNR portion of that, and probably a week from tomorrow on the PCA portion of that and what their plans are, because some of the money should be going from that. And right now they don't have many firm plans, and it's something that Minnesotans need to discuss. So I just welcome you to know about that.
When did you say that was?
Tomorrow morning,
8:15, 8:30? It's...
Okay, I'm driving up from Caledonia, Minnesota, so I didn't make plans. I'll try to stay on top of that best way I can. I'm planning on heading back tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you.
We've heard testimony. The draft has been amended by a committee. There have been suggestions through the public testimony. Because of the recreation area issue, it's already been suggested that you may have an author's amendment next week. We will not take public testimony anymore after today, and if there are going to be changes, they will be author's amendments or changes. But the main part of discussion on draft 2, which may be engrossed by next week, and will be draft 3 at that time, and then we will have the final vote next week. Thank you for your work. Is there anyone else that wishes to address draft 2 as amended before this committee? Thank you so much. Thank you for your participation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We've come a long way. The second item on the agenda today was brought to me by a meeting that I had with Commissioner Fink from St. Louis County and Commissioner Sweeney a couple weeks ago. I wanted to talk about the impact or how public ownership of land affects local governments and cities and counties. And so I thought this agenda was a good time to discuss the consequences of public ownership of land to local governments. And I invited them to come. And they, at this meeting that we had, they told me that the League of Cities had a big discussion about it at their annual convention, and that the Association of Counties, and that they had a resolution to present to the legislature. And so Annalee Gartletz of the Association of Minnesota Counties and Commissioner Fink. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Gartletz. Or Commissioner Fink.
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to start. My name is Dennis Fink. I'm a St. Louis County Commissioner. I'm also chair of the Northern Counties Land Use Coordinating Board, which is a board of 8 counties across northeastern Minnesota, or northern Minnesota, and I am a past president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you for allowing us to speak today. We want to discuss several subjects related to your oversight role with the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, especially activities where land acquisition is a priority or may occur. And it was really important to listen to the last discussion about the guiding principles being developed as suggested earlier here tonight. But I'm here to ask you to look at some of those parts and the outcomes of those criteria from a different point of view. And our concern is that there may be some possibilities, or a lot of possibilities, where land acquisition will occur, but it may not occur across the entire state where it might be necessary. For example, on page 3 of the outcomes of the document that you just looked at, the middle, the fourth bullet point down, it says existing public property will be complemented by acquisitions that provide expansion. Now, from a county that's 63% publicly owned, I would say that's probably not a very good idea. On the other hand, there are a number of counties that are not highly publicized or highly publicly owned. So if that went on to read something to the extent that provided those counties where that complementary land was less than 10% publicly owned already, then that might be a really desirable position to be in. But to assume other than that, it would appear that St. Louis County, again, or many of the northern counties would be under attack in terms of acquisition. I have presented, I hope the committee members all have a map that I sent, that I passed out. It represents ownership. And there's a legend in the bottom. Needless to say, I wanted to get your attention with how much publicly owned land there is in northern Minnesota. So all the counties in red are better than 50% publicly owned. There are 9 of them. All the counties in blue are greater than 10%, but less than 50%. There are 12 of them. So 21 of the counties in the state of Minnesota have 10% or greater ownership. The rest of the counties in white and yellow have less than 10%, and those in white are less than 5%. So from our perspective, we have these two very concerning criteria that shows up. Number one, there has not been a well-defined way of telling us how you are going to compensate counties for the loss of private land should it be acquired to be moved public. And for those of us who have greater than 50%, we already receive the lion's share of PILT. We are concerned that our land might be targeted. And we're not without good cause. Northern County's Land Use Coordinating Board brought to our meetings twice people from the Lessard Heritage Organization to tell us about what their goals and objectives are.
Excuse me, Commissioner, would you repeat that sentence again?
Sure.
We
invited members of the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Group to visit us and talk to us about what their goals and objectives were as they were looking forward. We understood that one of their main goals was acquisition. So we were concerned. In the meetings, and I have minutes of this at home if somebody really wants to see what the minutes look like. In the meeting, there was a great deal of discussion about how cheap the land was in northern Minnesota. Now, I can tell you the county commissioners that were sitting around the table listening to that, we were absolutely frightful that the criteria, the economic criteria for acquiring new land, at least new land that was going to fall into an outdoor heritage goal and objective, would be cheap land. It would have seemed to me that there would have been a little more social and economic or environmental concerns about that. And that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. I think that along with the guidelines and the principles that you are putting together, there ought to be at least an outcome that suggests that there is criteria that would include all three of those items: social, economic, and environmental criteria before acquisition could take place. Now, under those conditions, I certainly would make an argument that somebody in Pipestone, unless they already own a cabin up there and are paying taxes, shouldn't have to drive from one end of the state to the other end of the state to go hunting. Because environmentally, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. In fact, I have a commissioner on our board that would say to you, and his name's Mike Forsman, that would say it's much, much better to have a wilderness just outside of the city where everybody could, outside of the cities here, where everybody could ride their bike than to drive 250 miles to my wilderness and then complain about the fact that there was just a smell that they heard when I got out of the car that had something to do with fuel. The idea here is this. We agree with you that there needs to be, that across the state, there is a need, an absolute need for additional public land. But in those counties, which are 10% publicly owned or greater, that need interferes with our ability to be able to do our business on a day-to-day basis. With that in mind, I'm not going to talk specifically about the PILT because we do have a proposal, or there is a proposal that was on the table and we were asked to respond to it. And Anna Lee is going to talk to that about payment in lieu of taxes. And I'll have a comment on that afterwards and then we'll I assume she'll take some questions. Anna Lee.
Ms. Garlitz.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna Lee Garlitz and I work with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And as Commissioner Fink referred to, we have had lengthy discussions about payment in lieu of taxes. Specifically, and this is what I'll be talking about today, we have some overall positions relating to payment in lieu of taxes, but specifically, we also have some positions that we've recently adopted regarding the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Fund and land purchases according to that. And you've shared we've shared these positions with the Lessard Outdoor Heritage, Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, and we also, I believe, CC'd you back in December with the letter. Last year, Representative Dill and I believe Representative Wagenius put forward a bill that talked about, it had language talking about setting aside money up front when land was purchased with the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Funds. And there was also some language in there that was Representative Wagenius's that dealt with ongoing maintenance of those lands. And that was something that the Association of Minnesota Counties, as well as the Minnesota Association of Townships, supported. And we worked on that. We worked on some of the language for that last year. And we would greatly like to continue discussions about that this year as you go forward with talking about those. And we also note that you did talk about figuring out the upfront and the tails for the cost of land in your guidance document. So we did appreciate that being included in your comments. AMC has adopted a specific policy position for Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage dollars. And I'll read this to you and then I'll kind of go on talking about some of the other general pieces. Lands that are fee title acquisitions should receive fully funded PILT payments in recognition of perpetual loss tax base, service, and management costs. PILT payments should be in the form of an upfront payment made to the county that will be placed in an irrevocable trust held by the county. Lands acquired outside of a city must be approved by the county and not be in conflict with the county's comprehensive plan. Land acquisitions should emphasize the greatest level of public land value that can be attained in order to achieve the maximum statewide public benefit of the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Funds. And in addition, we've met with some other local government partners, the watershed districts and the soil and water conservation districts, to talk about this a little bit more. And this is one of the handouts that you have that should have been handed out to you. This was what was submitted to the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. And just some points to keep in mind as decisions are made when land acquisitions are being made. There's five of them. Won't read it all. But the first one is programmatic funding strategy. To choose a programmatic funding strategy rather than a project-specific funding whenever possible. To have a mix of both public and private projects that restore, enhance, and protect natural resources, a land acquisition policy that reflects and accounts for the full cost of public land, and recreational use and access policy that is situational and compatible with Minnesota landowners and adheres to the constitutional directive. And finally, a coordinated relationship between local water plans and use of the Outdoor Heritage Funds. We found that we're very appreciative of the work and the discussion that took place last year with the clean water dollars, and we see the Outdoor Heritage Funds as an excellent complement to those dollars as well. And if there's anything that can be done to use them all to benefit one another, is something that the groups were really supportive of. And that concludes the AMC piece of the presentation. I'll let Dennis.
Thank you, Ms. Garlitz.
Madam
Commissioner
Chair.
Fink.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I sit on the group of the group that got together with the other AMC members to develop the policy that was just put forth. But there is some concern about those counties who receive the bulk of this PILT payments, those red counties. And within your document, several pages back, there is a list of how the distribution of PILT occurs right now. It is called total gross PILT payments. That's at the top. And you will notice that of those nine counties receive almost half of the $21 million paid in PILT at this particular point. $9.9 million of the $21 million PILT payments that go through go to those 50 county or those 50% above counties. Now, our concern is this. PILT has always been and continues to be in these difficult economic times a target for the reduction of payments to counties. And we are a little worried, the nine of us, that should we find a way for the Heritage Group to fund PILT and have two separate accounts, one for those of us who are publicly owned and those who will be publicly owned, that there may be down the road, this is a 25-year program, some opportunity for us to lose the existing PILT. So while we're supportive of the fact that there needs to be payments for the new land that's acquired, we are concerned about having two separate pots. Even the fact that a payment is made for land acquisition directly to the local units of government causes us some concern, because we are thinking that might be accumulated in a trust fund somewhere, which may be, how do I put this mildly, accessed by state government. And so that concerns us. It concerns us a little bit that if we have these two pockets, we will then be forced to split our own organization as we try to defend them at some particular point. But I would not, in any circumstance, suggest that you not consider the AMC proposal, only that you recognize that from all counties' point of view, the money that will go to PILT will get larger and will become a target, or continue to become a target. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Questions, Ms. Garlitz or Commissioner Fink? Representative Hansen.
Mr. Fink and Ms. Garlitz, there are some that say that the word protect in the Constitution means acquire. Do you personally believe that the word protect in the Constitution means acquire?
Commissioner Fink.
In the Minnesota State Constitution.
In the Constitution Amendment that passed in 2008.
Ah.
Just. Only acquire.
You know, I do not. I think that the term acquired has been developed as part of the thought process that says, how do we implement? I think that protect includes a number of issues that may in fact mean conservation easements. It may mean some other tools that would be in place as we move down the road, including SFI, including some form of third-party verification. So I would think that there's this larger picture that indicate that protection might take place in this particular thing. But I have not heard or had a great deal of discussion about the most recent discussions that have taken place. I've just understood that there is some additional conversation going on about the definition of that.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Garlitz from the Association of Minnesota Counties, is it the Association of Minnesota County position that to protect is only to purchase, or could it be protection through easements also? What's the Association of Minnesota County's position?
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, AMC has not officially weighed in on definitions of each of these. What we have identified is that there's a need to have a mix of maintenance of existing lands, easements, and acquisition. So we don't have an official position, but we've talked about in our meetings with everybody that there needs to be an adequate mix that's going on.
So, Madam Chair and Ms. Garlitz, it sounds like the Association of Minnesota County's discussions would suggest that protection does not mean only purchasing land.
Ms. Garlitz.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be a correct assumption.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Garlitz.
Commissioner Fink, have you been, you said that you had invited people from the Outdoor Heritage Council to your meetings.
Yes, ma'am.
Have you made a presentation before the Outdoor Heritage Council?
Madam Chair, there is a letter to the council at this particular moment. We sent it out in early January, inviting the council back to us and it requesting an opportunity to make a presentation to them. Yes. We have spent this would not be the first piece of correspondence that's gone back and forth between the Heritage Council and others who are involved with the Heritage Council. The map that I passed out to you has Perham noted on it in Otter Tail County. You will note that is the furthest north that there is anyone who sits on the Outdoor Heritage Council as far as geographic location. And, of course, Otter Tail County is one of those less than 10% publicly owned counties. So we have been sending letters back and forth, including to the governor, suggesting that we are underrepresented, yeah, in spite of the fact that the red part of that map and the blue part of that map occupies nearly half of it. And so there has been a great deal of correspondence, and I am looking forward to making a presentation to them, not only about representation, but including the fact that we would prefer them to acquire elsewhere.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Gerlitz. Thank you, Commissioner. Craig Johnson, League of Cities. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson, here representing the League of Minnesota Cities. And I was asked to come in and talk a little bit about how cities are affected by state purchase of land. The first thing to be clear on, for those of you who get to deal with this all the time, is cities do not receive payment in lieu of taxes if the state owns land within their borders, except for the city of Columbus. Our newest city has a special statutory exemption to that because they have several very large wildlife management areas within their borders, and when they incorporated as a city a couple of years ago, asked that they be allowed to continue the payment in lieu of taxes they had been receiving as a township, and that was passed. So we have one city now that gets it. So the tax issue for cities really is more just a matter of when cities look at having a very limited amount of space and how that space can best be used to provide housing, commerce, transportation, green space, recreation, we have to weigh that very carefully because we have a very limited amount we can do without having to get into fights with our neighboring townships about how much more land the city might need. I think you'll get to hear some about townships later. So, what I can tell you, and I'm sure you're very well aware, is many uses of state land, of state purchase of land, are very popular with my cities. If you are able to use state land to accent local and regional recreational and trail connections and allow individual cities to become part of a larger network, it greatly expands their ability to develop tourism and economic links to those. A number of members here have seen that happen in their districts, and it really does magnify the local impact. So a local city might be able to develop a very nice park and trail system, but if you connect that park and trail system regionally to other park and trail systems, you end up with a place that actually might draw additional people in from outside the community much more easily. And I'm sure you've all been asked to carry many bills that make those kind of connections, so you've seen the enthusiasm for it. As far as concerns on state purchase of land, it really comes into where there might be differences between the users and adjacent property owners over conflicts of the land use. So, for instance, if there is a land that's going to be used for public hunting, we have to be worried about whether there are people who live so close to it that they're going to be very upset that there's guns being fired nearby, whatever. Those sites really are not put inside city limits or outside city limits almost always, except in the metro area. We have a few that are inside city limits, but that's more because of the growth of the metro area than because they were sited there after the city was formed. So, but we do have land use conflicts that come up. We have people that don't want trails with motorized vehicles on them going near their houses. We have, you know, those kinds of issues. And it really becomes a local issue frequently for us with our own parks and trail systems, so it echoes when the state decides to increase those activities. And really the only other big concern we typically have with state purchases is if it creates some kind of barrier or impediment. As you can guess, if you have a community that has very limited areas that they can grow in and the state suddenly purchases a large tract of land on the east side of town, well, it's virtually impossible for the city to do anything in that direction from that point on. Because even if the township allowed growth to happen and the county allowed growth to happen on the other side of that state land, it's very difficult to go across state purchased land in many cases to extend services, utilities, things of that nature to those properties. So overall, if the state is doing the normal job they do of planning and they're working with our cities on coordinating that planning with our comprehensive land use plans and the county plans, we very seldom run into those types of problems, but it is something we watch when the state is looking at new land acquisitions. So, members, overall, the work, and especially the work that I think is going to be done with a lot of the funds through the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment funds, is going to be projects for water improvement, for park and trail system improvement that our cities are going to be very supportive of and interested in helping to move forward.
Thank you very much. Rep. Sim Hansen.
Mr. Johnson, you sit in a lot of committee hearings representing the League of Cities, and you've been here for a while and listened to the debate on the dedicated funding over the years. And just checking, during that debate, when there was discussion, was there any discussion in committees, or have you ever seen any promotional material that said that the word protect in the constitutional amendment equaled acquisition? The protection was only acquisition.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, to be clear, you're asking if I have seen materials that say protection equals only acquisition. Madam Chair, Representative, I don't recall specific pieces. I have on several occasions in committee hearings heard the focus of the discussion be on that topic. Our cities would disagree with that. We do a tremendous amount of work to protect and preserve environmental features that is not through acquisition of public lands, through other mechanisms, one of which was mentioned earlier, urban forests. We don't acquire new lands to manage urban forests. We manage existing lands, and it is vital habitat, greenway connections, stormwater and rainwater support, soil erosion prevention, number of different benefits to it that doesn't involve acquisition of new land. It involves management of existing resources.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Rob Vanosik, Minnesota Association of Townships.
Skip over there. Good evening, Madam Chair and members. I'm pitching for Kent Sulem this evening and speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Towns and Townships. Most land that could or even should be preserved out and around the state does tend to be in townships. So further acquisitions by the state will have a disproportionate impact of the tax revenues and the residents that live in those jurisdictions on units of government already cut off from most state aid programs. Some townships already have over 85% of their land off the tax rolls. Townships are frequently required to take over road maintenance efforts to properties used only by the DNR, even though often there's no local benefit whatsoever. Thus, local taxpayers have to subsidize public use by largely non-residents of that jurisdiction. Towns don't oppose preservation efforts, but if land is being preserved, being paid for with state funds for a state benefit, we shouldn't penalize the folks in the local areas that are stuck with increased property taxes due to decreased tax revenues and potentially increased road maintenance costs. Any acquisition should be required to pay a premium that could be invested to offset the permanent loss of tax base, our members believe, such as the provisions that was alluded to by Ms. Garlitz from the AMC. We strongly support David Dill's language that he had drafted last year, I'll leave it at that and stand for questions. Thank you, members.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Vanosik, so are you saying that the Minnesota Association of Townships, if this money is spent to protect, you'd prefer easements to acquisitions?
We don't have a necessarily stated position of preference for easements versus acquisitions. We do have a long-standing policy position in our platform that our membership has adopted annually that states the association opposes any acquisition by the state of additional public land until pilt payments at least catch up to inflation.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Vanosik, so the townships do have an official position that they oppose acquisition?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Vanasa.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Vanasa. Mr. Larson, Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, for the record, I am Dan Larson, the administrator of the Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus, and I want to first of all thank you for the opportunity to talk about this issue, which is very important to our member counties. 25 member counties that operate as a caucus within the Association of Minnesota Counties. So, very important issue to many of our members, who are rightfully concerned about that in this era of rolling budget deficits at the state and federal level, how those circumstances impact them at one level, while on the other level they see continued acquisitions and a larger appetite for acquisitions, if you will, at the department or the legislative level, and now with the legacy funding. So I know that you can sympathize with our members who see those two pressures coming together with them in the middle. And ultimately, this is going to be a discussion by me in support of the payment in lieu of taxes program. This is something that is vital to our members. We don't oppose acquisitions. A lot of times what they do, what happens on WMAs brings people to rural areas of the state, and there's economic development there. But there is a cost when private taxable land goes public, and that's what we're talking about here. So in lieu of those formerly privately paid taxes, there is payment in lieu of taxes, and that's the state's property tax, if you will. So we're here to hopefully continue to emphasize the importance of payment in lieu of taxes. And with this committee, as you move forward in making your decisions on land acquisitions, that you keep in mind that at every turn that payment in lieu of taxes is an important and vital component of this ongoing program.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Questions? Okay. Mr. Larson, could you submit a list of the 25 counties that you represent to this committee?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Larson, there are some that say that the payment in lieu of taxes is not that big of an issue, that we should be able to just roll past that. And in terms of the constituents in the counties that you represent, how big of an issue would you say it is among your county boards and in ranking in terms of heat from constituents?
Well,
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I hope it wasn't any of my members that said that, but very important to, most, let me put it that way. Part of my testimony was already covered by Commissioner Fink. You saw the map. 19 counties in the state with 20 or more total acres in public lands. 14% have 30% or more total acres in public land, and 9 counties with 50% or more of their total acreage in public lands. 5 counties have 70% or more. So almost all of those counties are within my membership. I don't know if I answered your question, but it's important at least to my group.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
John Edmond, Explore Minnesota.
Thank you
for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. My name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. Appreciate this opportunity here to be here. I was asked to talk about the impact of public ownership on local units of government from a tourism perspective, and I'm not here really to say one way or the other, speak out in favor of acquisition or an opposition, but rather talk about what that impact has on our travel and tourism industry. And as you all know, parks, trails, and recreational facilities are all part of Minnesota travel, and travel is a huge part of the state. And I think it's important that this committee, when you're talking about the resource decisions that you're making, you put in basically everything that you're dealing with is impacting an $11 billion industry in the state of Minnesota, 245,000 jobs in every corner and every county of the state. 16% of all state sales tax in Minnesota comes from the leisure and hospitality industry. And so a lot of what we're dealing with does impact travel. And outdoor recreation, from a lot of our research, is one of the main reasons that people come to our state. They come here for our lakes and our parks and our trails and our rivers. And we're finding that to be true now more than ever. As people are not traveling as far, they're discovering what's closer to home. And there's a strong interest in not just state resources, but also local resources as well. And it's one thing that's important, I think, to think about. When I'm talking to travelers, they don't distinguish between whether it's a local park, a state park, recreational park, a recreational area, or however the definitions that you seem to all understand. Consumers really don't really make, they go there for the experience, and it's all interconnected. The biking, the hiking, the festivals, the arts, the history, that all impacts Minnesota. And local units of government, certainly they have an interest in this because of a lot of the management issues you heard about here, about quality of life issues that you're all dealing with, but also economic impact, and not only just from the state as well, but from the businesses that benefit from a lot of these recreational facilities. That's all part of the tourism economy. So really, I just want to leave you with the consideration when you're making these decisions that travel and tourism is a big part of this legacy amendment. Even though Explore Minnesota is not part of this, we're not receiving any of the dollars, I think it's really important that when you're considering this, that we connect the resources to the people. That's the whole point we're doing it, for the benefit of our citizens, for the benefit of our visitors, for the benefit of the local units of government, for the benefit of our economy. It's all interconnected. And if there's any way I can help you in your deliberations, please let me know. But thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Erdman, one of the jewels kind of in the metro area is the Vermilion River and the world-class trout stream that's there. And as we were debating the Vermilion Highlands a few years ago, it was suggested that, you know, we may have people flying in Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport for the opportunity to fish in the Vermilion River because of the high-quality trout stream that was right here and world-class. Has there been any, have you, in your communication with people and selling the state, has there been any follow-up with that, or has there been any interest in that type of local resource and marketing Minnesota that way?
Mr. Edmund.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I can't really speak to that specific project, but fishing is one of those things that we as the state tourism office are very involved with, more so than a lot of your other outdoor activities. Yes, we're involved with hunting, et cetera, but fishing is one of those things that can bring a lot of non-residents in. That's where we see their largest economic impact, and we're known for that. I think we have to do more, to promote the natural resources and the fishing and the things that you're talking about. And we started to do that, but we haven't been able to specifically track that project. But I guess, you know, a long way around your question is fishing's a huge part of the state, and it's what we need to be promoting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Meyer.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. If I could, before Mr. Meyer starts his presentation, the testimony we've had tonight deals with the counties, the townships, the cities, and to a T, it sounds like every one of them does not believe the protect equals acquisition. And from what I'm hearing from Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, some of their members seem to believe that the only way you can protect is to acquire. So I would suggest that the cities, the counties, and the townships make a contact with the members of Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council, Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, and express their concerns to them, because they seem very real. And it looks like we're down two paths here. One is to protect his acquisition, and we've had a lot of testimony tonight saying some county commissioner folks even saying, don't buy any more in my county. So I think we better head her off the pass here and get some communication going before these expenditures are made. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Meyer, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. I appreciate the ability to be here today. When I was inquiring about what you're going to have on your testimony, I was not aware that you're going to dive into these type of issues in this depth. So I'm lacking some information, but I'm going to have some general comments, and we can certainly continue this conversation if you so desire. Just a few things. First of all, the department only buys land from willing sellers with county board approval. So when we buy a wildlife management area, we go to that county board seeking approval to do that. There's a position that allows us to go to the district court to petition that. We don't use that. We rarely use that. So we always work with counties on purchasing of wildlife management areas. On parkland, we have to have the boundaries established of a state park before we can acquire that land. And we go to the county seeking county board resolution for that as well. So our boundary changes are always supported by local units of government, the counties as well. We work very closely with local units of government. The League of Minnesota Cities talked about those incompatible uses. Hugo Wildlife Management Area, we've worked on that wildlife management area with the local unit of government to make sure the restrictions are in place that people can live with, us being able to utilize those lands and those lands being there as well. In cases where we can't have a wildlife management area or we own lands that are not suitable for their purposes anymore, we try to sell those. Actually, we've been trying to sell some of those lands to balance the budget, the $6.44 million, and we need to come back in legislative approval. We'll have a couple more of those this year because these lands were acquired not with Game and Fish Fund dollars, not with LCCMR or any other dedicated fund dollars. They were acquired through transfer from some other government entity, Department of Administration, Veterans, things like that. So we're actively managing our land asset. working with our local units of government to do so. Roads were brought up by the townships. We have the State Park Road Account where we get probably $2 million a year that we use with local units of government to help do road improvements on those roads leading to state parks. One of the ones that come to mind right now was about $500,000 we allocated to Otter Tail County for a road that goes into Maplewood Park or by Maplewood Park, leading to Maplewood Park. So we're doing these investments with our stakeholders to make sure that we are covering some of our investments or the impacts that our investments have. We have other mutual aid agreements where there are impacts on parks. For example, up in Taylor's Falls, we give the county, or we have given the local unit of government money for helping to respond to accidents that occur. I'm not sure of the status of that appropriation right now, but it's not as much as they would like. But, I mean, we all know what the budgetary pressures are right now. So we're dealing with the local units of government actively on acquisitions and on the impacts. There are a lot of good impacts to these lands that we own as well. Go back to the land ownership really quickly. This map talks about public land ownership. I think we need to talk about, this says federal ownership, school trust. We need to go back and talk about the types of public lands that are out there. And also the ConCon lands and other decisions that the legislature and the department have made proactively to designate certain lands as certain units of the Outdoor Rec Act. So it's not all acquired lands, but there are payments in lieu of taxes that are paid on, for example, the thousands of acres that were designated as acquired for the consolidated conservation lands in north central northwestern Minnesota, where the counties receive 50% of the revenue off of those lands. The school trust lands that the state manages, those lands are managed in trust. The revenue is going into the school trust fund. So there's all sorts of different layers of the onion we need to peel back when we talk about public land ownership and those things. But I think, is there a question? Or
I can Representative McGinnis.
One of the questions that was alluded to and actually spoken to was when we get a piece of land, it comes with pill payment costs to the state, it comes with management costs. Help the committee understand how short of management costs that the department is right now with lands that it holds in fee or an easement.
Madam Chair, Representative
Commissioner Meyer,
I know that you've had House fiscal staff do an analysis of the parks and trails needs that go out into the future and the park and the park holding within holdings and things like that. I don't have that with me right now, so I know it's for the parks, the trails that are established right now on the books, I don't know, I think it was 2050 or something that Jim Reinhold's work outlined to be paid off.
Representative Wagenius.
I would invite the chair to hear from Mr. Reinholtz, who's our nonpartisan fiscal analyst.
I think we're going to do that next week.
Okay, but I'm talking about, that's parks, that's trails. What about all the other lands that we have acquired that you have, that you're supposed to be looking at in easement or in fee? All of those other lands, how short are we on maintenance dollars for those lands?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, we're in the process of trying to determine that actual number right now. The easements, many times we don't buy an easement that actually has management activities on it. Many of our easements provide access. For example, a trout stream easement provides access to the side of that river through that property owner's property, such as in Representative David's district, for a fisherman or woman to come down, might be 10 feet wide. We're buying that access, right, not the ability to tell that farmer what he or she cannot plant or what. There's certain restrictions on cattle in the water and things like that, but it depends on the type of easements we have. We're working on, let's just focus on the example of wildlife management areas right now. We're working on developing our new system so that we will be able to manage and know what those needs are. And it varies depending on the unit that's out there. The definition of the wildlife management areas, as their purposes are defined in the Outdoor Rec Act, are to provide the maximum amount of wildlife production. But we want to have the best habitat possible on those lands as well. So we're going through region by region, and getting track by track. We're trying to set up a system that we can do this through our land, through our area wildlife managers electronically, through a database that we can then track. I do want to say that our lands record system that we have been working on, that we received support for two bienniums ago and the following, just last biennial budget, I just saw a demo model of this, and it's going to bring us into the 22nd century as far as land management, easement monitoring and enforcement. All of these things will be able to be done tabletop, and actually you'll be able to go from here or from your desk and find out the most latest information on where the boundaries are, get a map of that, who owns it, how it was bought, how it's being managed, what the needs are. So I don't have a number. I'm sorry, I don't have an exact number. But we have done in the past two bonding bills when we've done acquisition, asked for acquisition and development dollars, so then we're acquiring new parcels. We have the ability to go in there and do the management of that land at the time we acquire it.
Representative,
but we're doing better on it.
Representative Guinness.
I think it would be helpful for this committee to at least get a range of how much we're short. We know we're short. We just don't know how much. We have been able to figure out how much we're short up for parks, how much we're short up for trails. But for the rest of what you manage, and an easement just saying we don't want cattle in it, we've said somebody has access, we've got to go out and check and see what that farmer has or hasn't done. We've lost easements because y'all didn't even know where they were. So,
and Madam Chair, Representative Guinness, I understand that, and we're doing a lot better job. We've done a lot better job in the past 8 years than we have in the previous 20 years on acquisitions, on enforcement, on monitoring. Conservation easements for the department are a relatively new tool. So we're learning as we go, but I think we're doing a pretty good job at it, and we'll come back and we'll talk about those numbers.
I appreciate
the opportunity to talk about that. But going back a little bit to some of the positive benefits about acquisition that we have on some of those outdoor rec units, the latest survey by the Fish and Wildlife Service shows that hunting, fishing, and wildlife watching generate $4.3 billion a year in expenditures in Minnesota. 30% of all hunting days in Minnesota, about 6.5 million days, were spent on public lands. Approximately 78% of all wildlife viewers in Minnesota visited public lands. There's a lot of other local tax benefits that are out there, recreational activities, lodging. I think Mr. Edmonds spoke very, very positively, talked about the positive impacts that are out there. But we also have to talk about the environmental benefits as well. The protection of the local water quality, soil erosion, you know, there's carbon sequestration benefits, other environmental benefits, and focusing on the payment in lieu of taxes issue. We've done an analysis on PILT, what a county would receive on PILT versus others. I think almost across the board, the payment in lieu of taxes that a county would receive versus the other tax classification revenue that they would receive, PILT is a comparable or sometimes higher than what they would get from a local or a private citizen paying taxes on those. So we can share that with you. People who have property that abuts up next to private lands, those lands are often valued higher than what they would be if they weren't there. People look to move to these places. Because of that, you'll see realtors staying next to DNR-administered land, lands posted that way for sale. And also, the more consolidated natural lands require less local government services than highly developed or fragmented parcels or ownerships because of roads, utilities, infrastructure, police, fire, ambulance. So having a consolidated ownership reduces the impacts. I know there's some work that the University of Minnesota has done on that we can certainly share with you as well. The cost of development, per se, in a rural area that are tacked on to the townships, the counties, local units of government for that police, fire, rescue, things like that. Rare, and you know, the SNA program, the protection of the rare and unique plant animal communities, providing that wildlife watching, and then the educational and research opportunities that those lands provide as well, protecting those rare opportunities that we have. We have the County Biological Survey that we've been supportive of, the legislature has been very supportive of, that identifies these plant and animal communities that need to be protected. Certainly the SNA program does that, and we also work with county governments as well for approval of those units as well. They provide recreational opportunities, hunting, things like that as well. So we can, I apologize for not being more prepared. I didn't know you were going to get into these types of discussions at this in-depth moment, or at this moment in this in-depth. So we can come back and talk more. We can talk one-on-one on what those things are as well. But there's a lot of stuff out there.
That was very helpful, Commissioner. I have a couple questions. Representative Loeffler.
Well, Madam Chair and members, it was just, I was intrigued by, and I appreciate Assistant Commissioner Myers' comments about working with the counties before they acquire land. And I've gotten the impression, though, that some of the land we acquire has first been acquired by a nonprofit, and I think that model is continuing to evolve in other new ways. And does that type of local government consultation typically take place then, or do you have any knowledge of how that works?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, our work with third parties has evolved probably much more eloquently than our monitoring stuff has. We have a third-party memo that we supply to the third parties before we enter into any agreements or understandings. I think all the third parties have a clear understanding of what we're looking for and how their opportunities for acquisition need to fit into our strategic plans. We have biennial acquisition documents that are out there that talk about our acquisition strategy for every biennium. So that may have been the case a while ago, but we're working very closely with all the stakeholders out there to make sure that they understand what we're looking for, so that we're at the point now where we need to be acquiring the best and the most strategic units and land opportunities as possible, looking at consolidating our holdings, making large units, looking where there is no access, or enhancing opportunities, and on the other side, selling off those ones that don't make sense and use those dollars to buy new ones. Once we get this $2.5 million thing we got to pay for out of the way. But I think all the stakeholders have a pretty good understanding of how we're supposed to do that, and I will share with you and members the copy of our third-party memo that we give to them. I mean, you could bring up some of these third parties and talk to them, but I think they have a clear understanding on how we need to work together, what our expectations are, and how we need to do that. Because we, as a state, we can't afford just to be doing that anymore. We have to use, you know, strategic acquisition. That's kind of what we're looking at right now. Enhance our benefits as much as possible.
Representative Haas.
Thank you very much. I had an interesting, as a county commissioner and past park director, I had an interesting going backwards state where we actually had a county ownership of an SNA, a cold water fen by St. Wendell's, which we gave to the state and worked out agreements, and actually that worked out. I Googled real rapidly because I really didn't know what a fen was, not less a cold water fen. And the first three sites that I came to, I gave directions to drain it in order to farm it. I said, well, that wasn't what I was really looking for. I noticed that if you run that blue area into that red area, you're going to maroon somebody, and I think it's the taxpayers that we would be worried about doing that too. But let me talk about the white areas for a second. In Stearns County, and we talked about this a lot last session, many of these white areas are providing regional park systems that are not being provided in the red, in the blue, and in the yellow, and are doing so with sometimes the help of the state, but they're also doing it for their own maintenance. They're doing it without any type of tax reimbursement, and they should be considered an extremely good deal by this committee and an extremely good deal by the state of Minnesota, and should have room at the table every time there's an opportunity, because that is really the best deal. They're begging to get land in there, especially in regional park land, and are elbowing to get it. And the people up in the red probably don't feel that same desire for the purchase as the people in the white. So I just wanted to put that advertisement in there.
Except
again.
On trails and linking trails.
Oh, do they ever. Yeah. And that has changed over. Some of these things have changed over very rapidly because I've been at meetings of 3,000 people with one for the trail and 2,999 against, you know. But, that has switched over now.
That's 25 years ago.
Oh, yes. And the large crowd yelled, "Give us Barabbas," and I knew I was in trouble.
It was kind of like going to a landfill meeting.
Yeah.
I remember those days.
Yeah, I do, too, and I'm almost over the twitch.
I used to say that's where the huffy hit the heifer out there.
Commissioner, you talked about working with the people and on purchasing and willing sellers and that kind of stuff. But with the, could you just tell us about the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council? Do they develop the list of projects that they're considering and bring it to the DNR then? Or does the DNR suggest to them where some projects could be because you already have agreements in place?
Madam Chair, I believe it's both.
Okay.
We went through, after their RFP came out, and we submitted packages, program-level applications for shallow lake restoration, for example, accelerated wildlife management, acquisition and development, I believe. But then also, in the language, at least that was passed last year, it required the commissioner to approve acquisitions before to deal with Representative Lawfer's kind of concerns. The commissioner has the authority to say, no, we don't want that. So with that in place, we work very closely with those stakeholder groups to make sure that we are on the same page and doing the acquisitions. And oftentimes, those sportsmen and women groups or wherever these proposals are coming from, they contact our area wildlife guys who know Farmer Joe's property down here and how that relates to this, and they know where everything is, and that's where the proposals start at the area level, on the, at least the stakeholder side of things. So, and there's a lot of communication between us and the council staff and the council members on specific and the project proposers. So, at least historically, what past 2 years, I guess, we've been working pretty closely to make sure we are acquiring those high value lands.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Meyer, we've heard testimony here tonight that there are PILT payments in arrears, I guess, for lack of a better statement. Townships are saying that payments are past due or not caught up yet, and I think you've reflected similar ideas in your conversation with Representative Wagenius. Is that the case? Are we up to date in our, is DNR up to date in its PILT payments for state land already purchased through the legislature?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, PILT is appropriated. It's a rather complex process, but it's appropriated to the DNR by the legislature as a line item within the DNR's budget. The monies are then transferred to the Department of Revenue, and they actually send out the checks. It was done that way because back in the 1980, or I think it was 1980, when the program was established, the department wanted to use those dollars to leverage Pittman Robertson or other federal funds that may be available. We're eligible to leverage funds to the max right now without that because of license sales, but that's the reason why it's done that way. And the money we get appropriated from the legislature goes right out to the counties on an annual basis through revenue. I think what people may be talking about are some ditch payments, which is another whole topic to talk about. So, yeah,
no, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Meyer, how should we address the issue that we've heard tonight then from the townships and the counties about PILT when it comes to acquisition of land from the Lassard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council recommendations. You said that you've worked hand-in-hand with them. It goes both ways. They've come to you with ideas. You've gone to them with ideas for land that's eligible for purchase out there. How should we deal with that? Who should pay those PILT obligations then?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I testified in Representative Wagenius's committee. The easiest way to calculate the PILT payment roughly is going to be $7,500 per $1 million of acquisition per year.
What's that?
$7,500 per $1 million of acquisition. Now, and that's based upon the appraisal of the land, purchase price. It's basically the same. I believe the Lassard Sams Council had received an Attorney General's opinion last year that stated that those funds were not eligible for PILT, but I think that opinion said that the legislature could change, if there was a law passed, that those funds would be eligible. Hmm. I'm not saying to do that by any means. I'm just kind of paraphrasing what the AG's office said. I'm interested, and we actually sat down with the Department of Revenue to evaluate or try to evaluate the 25% upfront payment proposal that was in Representative Dill's bill, or it might have been in Representative Wagenius's bill. And we just weren't able, it's hard to amortize that and try to figure it out, because then you also have to take into effect the distribution of payments to the townships and the school districts that occur in some classes of land for PILT, and how that would all take place and where those monies come from. Back in the 1980s, they came from the general fund. It was developed as a local government aid type program to offset the local tax lack of ability for those local units of government to collect tax revenues on those lands. So I don't know what the easy answer is. It's historically been general fund. I don't know if there's any other type of fund. One of the things that I think there are other things you can give counties or counties need besides just cash, especially in northern Minnesota. Wetland credits are an issue where we would acquire and restore. Is there some opportunity to provide some access to some of those counties for credits as they construct? I know Kuchiching County, for example, I think paid $12,000 an acre for wetland credits to construct a hospital. I think that's the number. But those northern counties have huge impacts, and that's one thing that may be a benefit to them. I don't know. Trying to find new incentives, I think, is one thing that needs to be done, and we will do whatever we can to help the committee and stakeholders try to develop those new tools as well.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Meyer. I'm glad we're working on this. It seems to me from the testimony we've heard tonight that the townships and the counties in particular are not yet satisfied that we're doing well enough. It seems to me we have really three options on PILT. One option would be not to account for it at all, which, as I gather, the townships and the counties would not at all be happy with. One option would be for the DNR to pay for it in their general program budget that gets passed through House committees. And the third option would be, if it's an acquisition request that comes through the Lassard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, that somehow we work out a way that they could cover that cost, since they're the ones recommending the land. Do you have a preference of those three options, or is there an option I'm not considering?
I'd rather answer Representative Hansen's question about the protector.
I know your answer to that question, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I apologize. Representative Morgan. Ultimately, it's up for the legislature to decide. We'll do our best to try to figure out that question and where it should come from. Historically, it's always been a general fund type program. You know, other states do it differently. And we can certainly have that discussion as well, what other states do. But it's something that needs to be addressed, because I think there are huge generational values to these properties. Also, economic and recreational impacts that are out there as well, and we need to try to figure out how can we continue to provide the needs or the wants of all of our stakeholders that want to protect and utilize and conserve these lands. So it's not an easy question to answer, I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, you sure gave us a lot to think about.
Yeah. That's
and I appreciate that a lot.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair.
Thank you for offering. Is there anyone else that wants to talk to the committee tonight? Welcome. Anglers for Habitat.
Members of the committee, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. That's what I'll be speaking to you as today. One of my other hats to wear. Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance.
Okay.
I would also like to talk about wildlife management areas because in 2001 I was chairman of the Wildlife Management Acquisition Report. And I would like to know how many members have even seen the report. Thank you. If you have read the report, you would note that all the lands that were targeted in the Wildlife Management Acquisition Report are not in the counties that were suggested earlier. They're targeted in the less than 10% counties. That is the target portion of the Wildlife Management Acquisition, not in the over 30% counties that have more than 30% public land. So in addition to that, some of these public lands are state or federal, federal lands, not state lands. For example, the Boundary Waters or National Forests. So those are huge tracts of public land that belong to the federal government. I just wanted to point out those minor changes. But if you have looked at the Wildlife Management Acquisition Report, it also calls for a certain amount of acquisition to take place every year. I note in the House bonding bill this year, that has been zeroed out. We're very concerned about that.
Right.
That's my comments, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Davids.
Madam Chair, and sir, I think you're kind of missing the point here. The point was, I think, to get on the record, do these various groups, whether it be cities, counties, or townships, believe that the only definition of protect is to acquire? So I don't care what report somebody's read. That's not the question. I don't understand where you're going with that, because the question was to the cities, townships, and counties, what does your definition of protect mean acquisition or easements or combination thereof? So I don't understand where you're going with that, Madam Chair, if you could just explain.
Mr. Ness.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids. In the earlier testimony, some of the counties had stated that they were afraid that the acquisition would take place in those counties of more with more public land in them. That is not the intent of the acquisition. Back to the question of, is protect the only way, or is acquisition the only way to protect lands? And the answer is no. The legislature has the power to enact laws that can protect various environmental concerns. You have the ability to cause regulations to protect.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ness, this isn't the bonding committee, but since you brought it up, are there any parts of the House bonding bill that you do see as favorable when compared? I would presume you're comparing to the governor's or the Senate's recommendation. Just for my purposes, I don't serve on that committee either.
No, and I will address that in Representative Wiginius' committee, Representative Morgan, Madam Chair. There are parts, yes, we're concerned about aquatic management areas as well, back to my Anglers for Habitat hat, and also SNAs. So we're concerned about several avenues that seem to be underfunded at this point. Compared to the department's recommendations, we're supporting the department's request at this point.
Representative Wiginius.
In the House's bonding bill, and you may not have seen it, we put in $30 million for acquisition of wetland easements. What that means is we get an additional $42 million from the federal government. That's $72 million for wetlands. Now, it has been my understanding that there are folks, hunters, who have been lamenting the fact that ducks are way down in Minnesota. Ducks need wetlands. I think you and I probably agree with that. The ability to get this federal money may not last. When we look at the federal debt, We may never have this opportunity again. Unfortunately, even with our putting $30 million on the table, Minnesota is going to be leaving money on the table that could be spent for wetlands. It's still not enough. So I look at that match. I think it's a terrific match. Why wouldn't we take the opportunity that's presenting itself?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Ness.
Representative McGinnis, I agree with you, and we're very happy about that portion of the bill. I believe Representative Hansen has actually sponsored that legislation. We support that. He has a letter and indicated from our groups that we support that avenue. And we do realize this is a very important thing. When there's federal government matching money, that was part of this whole Constitution Amendment. We should be able to match money when we can, wherever we can. What you're telling me is that in the order to match that money, someone else must suffer. And in this case, wildlife management areas is being deleted or zeroed out. That's the way I look at it.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ness, I just want to clarify, because you said you supported the governor's bonding proposal.
No, the division's, excuse me, Madam Chair, the DNR's recommendations. Oh.
So the you would rather, well, I think that's the governor's, you would rather have the $30 million of RIM and the bonding house bonding proposal than the $4 million in the governor's bonding proposal or the $10 million in the Senate's bonding proposal. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Ness.
No, I don't think that's quite correct, Rivers Hansen. We'd like to have both, actually, like a lot of other folks. But we understand the federal matching money is important with the wetlands. That money is important on there. But we also feel there's, you know, some money should be spent on wildlife management acquisition.
Representative Hansen.
I need to clarify again, because the governor's bonding proposal has only $4 million for RIM, for WRP. And the Senate bonding proposal only has $10 million for RIM WRP. And so when you're saying the governor's bonding proposal, I'm asking you, of those three choices with RIM WRP, are you supporting the governor's $4 million, or are you supporting the House's $30 million?
I would rather support the House's position in that point.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Ness.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. In your packets, there's a written testimony from our friend David Markle, who has appeared before this committee and has submitted written testimony in the past. I strongly recommend that you read that. In your packet is a submission for the guide from Isis Stark, and you've read that, Representative Morgan, and the Tom Jess letter, and the comments from Susan Schmidt about Draft 2, Legislative Guide, and comments about from Chad Roberts, the Executive Director of Dakota County Historical Society, and a letter from Norm Moody, who is happy to, is a retired land commissioner from Cass County. Before us, we have two young men who are going to be our pages, Reed Anderson and Mike Bain. Mike Bain. You can go first, Mike, and please come to the table and tell us a little bit about yourself and your education. What brought you here, and what about culture and outdoor resources really excites you?
What do you think? Well, I was born in St. Paul, grew up in Shoreview, and then went to high school and University of Minnesota. Graduated back in 08, and this is my first foray into seeing how the sausage is made, if you will. So, pretty excited. And cultural and outdoor, big supporter, very important. Kind of on the spot here, but hope anything I can do can help this process go very smoothly.
How long does he have to go to get this pitcher in here?
Does the gentleman believe that the protect means to acquire?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bain. Mr. Anderson.
Okay, well, this is my first year as a page at the house in college. I went to St. Olaf College where I studied environmental policy, so this is kind of the field where I studied a lot in college. I was able to do an internship with Rick Hansen during my sophomore, junior, and senior year, so I think this is an exciting opportunity for me to get some first-hand experience in this field, and looking forward to helping all of you out, so
Thank you. In your packets is copies of the 32nd meeting, the 33rd meeting, the 34th meeting, and the 36th meeting.
I'd like to move the minutes there.
Representative Haas moves that we adopt the minutes as printed. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The minutes are adopted.
The 36th one wasn't that good.
Next week, we are going to complete discussion on the legislative guide, draft 3, and we are going to have some discussion of finance issues that will be listed in the agenda, and we are going to be presented with reports from those people or organizations that had to present a report to us before the beginning of this legislative session. Any other further business? Thank you all for staying. Thank you for being attentive. This meeting is adjourned.
Let's go, Purple.